My name is Eric Monk, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And if you wonder why I called you here tonight, no, I'm just kidding. All joking aside, the guy who's going to speak to you tonight I've known since I got into recovery. He and I went to an indigent treatment center together, and then I watched this guy come in and out of recovery, and I watched him grow from those experiences. He never stayed down for very long, and I watched him this last time grab a hold of this program in a way that we do when we work the steps in succession with the sponsor that's worked the steps with the sponsor that's worked the steps, and then started to commence to work with others. And today he lives this program. Not his program, not my program, but the program as it's outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So tonight it gives me great privilege to introduce Wes R. from Newport Richey.
So, my name is Wes Rogers. I am a recovered alcoholic. And now you've seen the jacket, it's coming off. Ooh, Todd. My sobriety date is December the 13th, 2007. I have a sponsor, his name is Dan Lanahan. I also have another sponsor, and that's for multiple reasons, who was not here tonight, and I sponsor others. I have a home group, How Important Is It? Meets on Wednesday nights at 7:30 in Hudson, Florida, if anybody's interested. It's a long drive, but hey, you know, a bunch of crusty old timers, which is great. So, I am a fish out of water in Florida. I am from Alabama and surrounded by Yankees. So, it was an interesting experience coming to Newport Richey, but that's a long story. But anyway, I grew up in a normal family, you know. Mommy didn't put me on the potty sideways or anything crazy. Came from a somewhat affluent family that loved me and gave me every opportunity. You know, I have nothing bad to say about my family. In fact, they stuck it through thick and thin with me through a lot of years until I finally got sober. And I'm very grateful for that because I have nothing but the utmost love for my family. If anybody that knows me real well knows how I care about them. So I just got this thing called alcoholism. And I knew from an early age that I was a little left to center, a little odd in the crowd, and couldn't understand why, and I hated it. You know, I always had a big mouth, always ranted a lot, always caused myself extra trouble in this world. And at around 15, I had attempted to drink a couple of times, never could choke down enough to get a buzz. But at about 15, I was with my girlfriend, and her sister had a party and had a keg, and I guess it was tasting right that night, and I got enough down to get a buzz. And I tell you, you know, all those fears, all those thoughts of feeling different and all that all went away. And, you know, I got to third base that night and got drunk. And, I mean, life was great, you know, for a 15-year-old. She was 16. She had a car. So, and she's a private school girl and Catholic girl and definitely taught me how to drink. And we had a good time together. And like any good alcoholic, being selfish and self-centered, we, you know, our Friday and Saturday nights where we'd go find somebody to buy us beer, or I'd get my older sister. You know how you use different people at different times, not too much, to get what you're looking for. And then we'd go behind the church because we learned through bad experience behind schools, park rangers go by, this, that, the other. But behind the church, man, nobody ever checks on a Saturday night. And, you know, all I cared about was having sex and getting drunk. And then we'd stop at McDonald's on the way home. And that was a beautiful evening for me. You know, that was great. So, I wasn't Mr. Social to start with. Like I said, my mouth always got me in trouble. And but even though with the drinking, I could still go to the parties and I could attend and feel okay because I had alcohol in me, you know, and it just removed all those fears. And I had found what I had been looking for because it put me right. It set me right. I did a lot of other things. A lot of other types of things that never set me right, but alcohol did every time till the end. So got into bartending at 21. Well, I got into a lot of legal trouble at around age 20, dealing with some outside issues and got caught selling it, and almost went to prison for a while. It was the first time mom and dad kind of stepped in and did a little bit of enabling and cut a check to a lawyer and got me out of trouble, and I was quietly escorted out of Pike County in central Alabama and told never to come back. And my neighbor's good friend was a probation officer, and they got me set up with him. I don't know how all this happened. Again, I was oblivious to most anything at the age of 20. And they never drug tested me. They never did anything. I paid my little $20 a month, and in 3 years I was off probation. And I got into bartending at 21. What a great profession if you're an alcoholic. I mean, the best. So, but during that time, and it's funny because I was talking to my sponsor on the way here about my story, and I think I wanted to hit up, and it's funny because we have some friends here from the medical industry, but just some of my escapades in a lot of treatment centers, because I went through about 17 of them, so but we'd step into that a little bit tonight. But I went to my first outpatient treatment center at the age of 20, Parkside in Mobile, and this is one that I just don't remember much. I remember the lady that ran it, and she was in AA, and I just remember her, because I can remember asking her, you mean I got to go to one of these meetings every day for the rest of my life? And she said, you know, I don't eat, sleep, and shit, AA. And I remember her specifically saying that, because I held on to that, because I, you know, that gave me excuse not to go to any meetings, you know what I mean? That's what I heard. So, but that's about all I remember from it. So 5 years, I did a lot of drinking, did a lot of damage. But it was followed by very few consequences. Bartended, made great money. About this time in Mobile, they had started opening up a lot of little bars on a strip, kind of like a Bourbon Street. It was on Dolphin Street here in Mobile. And Mobile is very French-oriented, so it's very similar to New Orleans, just on a much smaller scale. And we'd go down and, you know, all the people that worked down there, because I worked in a brew pub, another great place, man, another great place, because you could steal all the beer you want, they didn't know. But we would get drunk and have fun, and I'd go home, and first real consequence I got was in 94. It was my birthday. I turned 24 years old, and the girl I was with, we were out. We had been drinking all night, and she looked at me, and she said, let's go home. Let's go take a bath. I'm all excited, and I get in my car, and I remember I knew I shouldn't have drove because I'm seeing double, and this is one of those rare occasions that I'm that kind of drunk. And I remember rounding a curve and doing a 360, and I said, well, you probably need to slow down because you're going a little fast. But I kept driving, and an off-duty cop coming out of Waffle House saw me drive by, pulled me over, and said I was doing 90 in a 35. I just remember thanking him. I don't remember much from that night. That's my first real consequence outside of being arrested years ago. Got out, lost my license. Still drove. That didn't stop me from driving. Again, it's funny because I can remember all since I've been sober, but there's so many parts of my life that, and it's not the alcohol. It's the true oblivion to how selfish and self-centered we are that I don't remember any damage or anything going on because all I cared about was getting drunk, and as long as that didn't get stopped, it didn't matter. So I don't remember a lot of the details, and it's not because I was in a blackout. It was because I just didn't care. You know, and that's that extreme selfish and self-centeredness. So I get an opportunity to become a bar manager of a new brew pub in Birmingham, and so I moved there. This time we started opening stores. We opened one in Kentucky and some other places, and I made Birmingham my home store, and I started dabbling in some extracurricular activities there, and it really started to speed up my drinking and my alcoholism. I was making a killing, man. You know, as a bartender, you got all these fives, ones, and tens you get from tips and stuff. And I had a sock drawer that had about $7,000 cash in. And then the extracurricular, there's a Freudian slip, extracurricular activities, within 2 months, that drawer was shot. And that started a real downward spiral. You know, I knew I'd been stealing from work, and I knew that I was going to get caught. So I quit before I got caught, you know, way to save face. Did some other odd jobs, this, at the other. I finally called my parents up, and I said, look, I said, I think I got a little problem with alcohol. And, of course, they're like, come home, come home, come on, we'll help you. So So I moved back to Mobile, and for 3 months I lived at home. And my father would get up every morning and he would check the trunk of my car, and if the golf clubs were gone, he knew I pawned them and he knew what I was up to. And I remember this is the first time one of those things that sunk in. One morning he wakes me up and he says, "You know, you pawned your clubs again." He said, "You know, at least when you were living in Birmingham, you were out of sight, out of mind. And that, as hard as it was to live with, was better than this." I went on a little weak bender with a little credit card of his in Birmingham. And you know you're bad when you piss your dealer off and he pretty much kicks you out. We were staying in hotels and they kicked me out. And I spent my first night on the streets. I slept underneath a bridge. Now, I know it's cliche. I slept in underneath a bridge in Birmingham, and I stayed on the street for a day or two, and then I said, "It's too much for me." So I called 911. I tell them I want to kill myself, and they send me an ambulance. They take me to the hospital, and the doctor takes one look at me and says, "You got to go," and they kick me right back out. So what does a guy like me do? I call my mom and dad and say, "Okay, you know, I give. I got more than an alcohol problem. I got a couple problems." So, you know, considering that I pawned the vacuum cleaner, the VCR, vacuum cleaner I got $5 for, by the way. So, and I did some damage during that time, too. My mom's mother's, my grandmother's wedding ring that they had passed away. I pawned it, and before they found out, it had passed that 90-day mark, and they couldn't get it back. You know, that's one of those that you can't make up for. So they send me to Montana, to a place called Wilderness Treatment Center. So now I'm in an inpatient. I mean, this is, you know, high class. The problem for me was I'm 25 years old, and the next nearest age to me is 20, and most of the kids in there are 18, 17 years old. So manipulation's not very difficult for this. And the counselor's, you know, very hippie, touchy-feely kind of place, you know, nature and stuff like that. And that's my first real experience with, they did talk about the 12 steps, but with treatment centers and stuff. And they talked a lot about your childhood and introspective and yourself and stuff. And, you know, I was taking what they said. I kind of half-assed wanted to get sober. I more or less just wanted the problems to go away. And we got through. And they told me that they wanted to send me to a place in Omaha that was a halfway house that they wanted me to further my treatment. So I said, okay. Like I had a choice, you know, I'm in Montana with no money. I don't want to go anywhere. And by the way, it's freaking cold in Montana. I was there from November until January and never saw the ground. It was all snow. So we saw snow once every 4 years, half an inch, you know, a little bit. Not much difference from here except for you don't get any snow here. But anyway. So I go to Omaha, great halfway house. You walk to your meetings, got 18 guys in a house. Every week, you switch rooms. You got one-man room, two-man rooms, three-man room, four-man rooms. And you're switching rooms, so you get to know everybody. You have to get a job that you're home at the house by 5:30. If you're 1 minute late, you get booted. They kick you out of the house. There's an alumni list. You got to call down this alumni list and find somebody willing to let you stay with them for a couple of days. Every moment of your day was structured. That's about all I remember from this place. we started going to meetings. Had a great speaker meeting on Sunday night. Had about 300-400 people at a bingo hall. It was the fun place to work, to hang out. But it's funny, you don't hear anything, at least I didn't, when you're not interested in getting sober. You know, I just didn't have anywhere to go at the time. I had relapsed one morning. We went to do some side work at this guy's house, and he had some pills in his bathroom. And then next thing you know, I was working at a little place like a Subway, but it was a little satellite shop in an office complex, and only one person worked it. And so I stopped and got a couple quarts of beer and went to work one morning the day after that. And then I closed the shop up 2 hours early and took $50 from the till and went out to the dopo. So that didn't fly well. I didn't lose my job over that. That amazes me. They kicked me out of the halfway house. I go in there. They have three-quarter houses there. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. They have the nice one for the people that graduate And then they've got two out in the middle of just the worst part of town for people like me that didn't graduate. It's a place to stay so they just don't kick you on the street. And that's your last chance. So I get back in the halfway house, graduate, go back into the nice three-quarter house. 2 weeks later, I'm back at it again. And this is where life gets a little serious. You know, the thing I hated the most was the shame and the guilt. And instead of stopping drinking, I just cut everybody off and didn't call anybody. And I stayed. I always worked. Always had a job. But I lived on the streets of Omaha for about a year and never called anybody. Just dropped off the face of the earth. And I say that because I got later on got a chance to see the real damage I was doing to my mom. I mean, just destroying her. But I didn't want to hear somebody telling me not to do what I wanted to do anymore. I wanted to be free, and that's what I thought. I'm free. And I wasn't free. I mean, I'm still dealing with all the demons in the head. I did a lot of things that people shouldn't do during that first year on the streets. Did a lot of damage to myself. I finally had had enough. I called my mom and dad again and said, look, I'm serious. I really want to get sober. Perfect. We got a place we want to send you. They'd already found and done their research. They sent me to Talbot in Atlanta. And I apologize. I've been told by a couple friends I shouldn't name places. So, but anyway, I go to High Dollar Treatment Center. There they give you an addictionologist. There's also your primary physician, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a primary therapist, a group therapist, a family therapist. They got more degrees with people walking around here. And it's the first time in my life I kind of said, okay, maybe I need to settle down and get sober. And I learned all this great stuff. We learned about King Baby. We learned about, I can't think of half the crap we learned, you know. And we learned, you know, the Dr. Talbot was one of the ones that actually proved genetically, you know, for people who had crossed the line that you could tell were alcoholics. He was the leader in the research in the field at the time. And it was great because I learned. I got all this self-knowledge because that's what I got there. I had no solution whatsoever, but I had all this self-knowledge. And I was kind of white-knuckling it. I graduated, and I had about a year. And I remember back then they used to put ephedrine in the Alka-Seltzer-Cold Plus tablets. And so I remember taking 5 and 6 of those. And that was, you know, I'm not relapsing. I'm just, you know, just experimenting. So, and I met a woman. It's amazing because that kind of slows that stuff down. And we fell in love. I had gotten in radio, gotten into a career that I liked, and was working at a little rural radio station in the north end of Atlanta. Met this girl. We fall in love. I move in with her. Everything's going great. I scratched the cornea of my eye at about 6 months of sobriety. I had about a year and a half of sobriety. And we've been dating 6 months, and I couldn't sleep, so I go to the emergency room. The doctor gives me a script. 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm filling the script, going home, taking 4. Mental blank spot. Had not a cloud on the horizon for anybody here that knows our book. There was nothing wrong in my life. I had a gorgeous woman who she made $80,000 a year. I had a nice house to live in the suburbs. I had a great job that I absolutely loved to do. But I had absolutely no solution, no spirituality, and that mental blank spot situation presented itself, and I jumped on it. And within 48 hours, she had changed the locks. I ended up back into the detox. I blew a .35. A .35, and I'm talking to these people like I'm stone cold sober. And I had been sober a year and a half. And that's that progression of that disease. I want to make sure I stay on my time here. So they send me back through another stint through that rehab. It didn't take. By this time, I'm done with the high dollars. I'm done because the shame and guilt of the money my family spent. I can't do it anymore. And then we started in with what Eric calls the indigent places. I went through a state run there, got kicked out for fighting. Did a couple stints in this halfway house where basically as long as you paid your rent, they didn't care what you did. So basically, it was a place to play weekly without deposits, but people there were getting drunk and doing all sorts of stuff. The guy that ran the place, let's just say, had all sorts of ulterior motives, really found some shady places. Atlanta's a pretty scary place at times. So I end up kind of getting my act together on my own, and I met this guy, and we start a little business. He has all this knowledge in construction, and I have a truck, so I'm more valuable than he is because he got a truck. So we start a business together, and in 6 months, we were doing pretty good. We had a couple of little guys working for us, and we were getting jobs. So I get about $300-$400 front money to do a job, and I go on a tear. End up in a hotel in South Atlanta. When I'm done doing what I like to do, I start hitting the bottle hard, and for about 2 days, I'm hitting the bottle. And I remember somewhere in there getting an idea that when we were kids, we had a beach house in Alabama, and I just remember how much serenity I had with hearing the ocean and all that. So I hitchhiked to Florida, and
No truck.
No. That stayed there. So, and you know, half of me says I can get what I want cheaper in Florida, and the other half of me says I can get the ocean and serenity. I mean, you know, really fighting the demons. And I remember kind of coming to, and I'm in this 18-wheeler, and the guy says, you know, you might want to try Tampa before you go to Miami. And he lets me out at Brandon. And so, welcome to Tampa. This is 2002. Stayed at the Red Shield Lodge, the Salvation Army down in Tampa. And great ideas that we get when we're out in the midst of all this thing. I said, okay, I'm gonna. It's like for the first week's free, and it's $7 a week after that or something. I'm going to do day labor for 3-4 weeks, save up $400 or $500, hitchhike to a little small town on the beach, go find me a girl that works at Hardee's or somewhere, and I'm just going to smoke weed and I'll be okay. Didn't get off work the first day, cashed a check, and one beer is not going to hurt. 3 months on the streets of Tampa, 3 months later, in a trailer that I was kind of sort of trying to crash in. Multiple people were shot and killed in it, and I said, okay, it's time to get out of Tampa. I'm hitchhiking up 275. This is 2002. They were working on the interstate, so there's nowhere for anybody to pull over. I'm jumping off at every exit trying to get as much water out of the little faucets at the gas station because I'm dying. It's so hot. And I get up to Fletcher, and I see this big sign. It says ARC, Adult Rehabilitation Center, Salvation Army, with a big arrow. Sign from God. Jump the fence. I'm getting in. And it was a Sunday. I had to wait till the next day. So I get in. And it was great, man. I mean, you know, they fed you like a king. The 5 men in the room was a little crappy, but, you know, I was off the streets. Graduated. I always graduate these programs. I'm good at finishing these things. So didn't buy into anything. And at the time, that Salvation Army, they weren't really sending us to a lot of meetings. I got on payroll there, got a job driving the trucks, and worked for a year and a half, 2 years. And never really did anything in the program. Went to a bunch of open discussion meetings. Never really kind of wanted to get sober and was just white knuckling it. And that was the longest I ever stayed sober on my own. And then around 2004, I started using off and on. And that's been a year living with a buddy until I stole everything in the apartment and gave it to somebody that wasn't going to say anything. Pawned one thing, a $20 CD player. Everything else I sold to somebody else. And he went to that pawn shop, and they had my name, and I caught a felony charge for $20. Spent a tear, and I stayed away from the cops. Spent a tear on the streets. I was on Nebraska for a year, right around Lime Ball and Nebraska, and some rooming houses off and on, and some hotels down Bush. And you guys probably know the area, so everything you ever want is right there. And finally, I'd had enough of that. I go back in the Salvation Army another time, another halfway house in between there, and I'm done. I want to get sober with every fiber in my body. And I can remember sitting in the Salvation Army upstairs at night praying with everything I had, and I couldn't get past the God thing. You know, the Salvation Army is a Christian facility, and Christianity's great, but for some reason, for me, it was a roadblock. I couldn't get past it. I couldn't get past the heaven and hell and some other things, and this is my story, you know, and I didn't know what to do, and so this doubt that I didn't know how to get past, we just went on with the steps, and I stayed sober and did pretty well, and stayed sober almost 2 years, and then fell off pretty hard again, went back to the Salvation Army for another stint. And at this time, I had met some of these guys here. He gives me a CD of somebody that sat in my car for a year. I should have played it before a year. So I'm in and out. I fire my sponsor. I ask this guy over here to sponsor me. I need $300 to pay my electric bill. This man was about to give it to me. Thank God he didn't. And I go on my last tear, and I want to get into the sober part because that's the best part. But I had never tried controlled drinking. You know, it talks about it in our book, controlled drinking. So I said to myself, I'm just going to drink one quart of beer. I'm going to go to bed, watch Frasier, and go to bed. Now, of course, non-alcoholics don't think like this. And I wait till 9 o'clock at night. I drink that quart of beer. I watch Frasier. I go to sleep. Oh, man, I did it. All I could think about at work the next day was what I was going to do when I got off work. And I got off work, and I started drinking, and I got on the hard stuff. When I get on the hard stuff, it gets crazy. And I end up going to work the next morning after drinking all night, and I looked at my – I worked with my sponsor in construction, and I said, you know what? You can have all my tools. I'm done. We were in Clearwater somewhere, and that was it. I went on a tear for about 4 days, a good brownout. And the part that everybody – I got about five or six close friends here that have heard this, like, way too many times. But – the last thing I remember was drinking a bottle of Mad Dog 2020 I stole from the store, which I love it because they put a little curve on it, make it perfect to put in the pocket. You can steal it and walk away. It was just great. And I go back in the woods. I start turning it up. That's the last thing I remember. When I come to, I'm laying on the sidewalk. There's a bottle of Wild Irish Rose sitting next to me. There's an ambulance driver over me, and he goes, you know, you've been reported as a dead guy on the sidewalk. That's what it took for me to get a moment of clarity. You know? So I remember parts of the ambulance. I talked to my old sponsor about a year ago, and he said that I called him when I was in the ambulance. I don't even remember that, and asked him where I was. But anyway, hospitals know me at this point, so they got me in, pumped me full of fluids, and got me out. But they did give me a list of treatments of detoxes. So I sleep in the bushes of the because I get out about 2 a.m, and I get up the next day, and I don't know where to go. And I see there's three different places. I call one of them. They said, yes, we can take you today. And they tell me they're up in Newport Richey. So I start heading north as best as I know. Don't know where I was. We found out about 4 years later where this was, by the way. It's kind of a neat story. I sit down on this bench, and I look over, and there's right outside this building is a circle with a triangle. And I'm going, holy cow. So I sit about 10 minutes, and the truck pulls up. Guy comes over and starts talking to me, and I told him my predicament. So he hands me like $3, and he tells me what bus to take, where to get off and transfer, what bus to get on in West Pasco, and tell that bus driver at that point where to drop me off. I mean, it's amazing this guy knew all this. He's driving a truck. What the hell does he know the bus schedule for? But, you know, so I do it, and I end up getting into the detox, end up getting into another halfway house. Lo and behold, the lady there says, you need to go to AA to get your sobriety. God, greatest gift in the world. This time I had listened to this speaker, and that's the guy that's coming, for anybody that knows what he was announcing. He's going to be here next weekend. I'd never heard anybody talk like this. All my life, I'd either been in open discussion meetings, hearing people talk about their freaking problems, or I was given all this self-knowledge of these treatment centers about how mommy did put me on the potty sideways, I just didn't know it, or God knows whatever else. And I had not really, and I'm sure that somebody talked about a solution, but it's so convoluted with everything else going on. The meetings that I was going to, I didn't hear it. And this guy talked about a real solution. He talked about being recovered. He talked about going out and getting on the fire lines and helping others. He talked about living a normal life and not having to live in AA, you know, and being a free man. And I'd never heard any of this. And that's what I wanted. So, hence my sponsor right here. I hear him share in a meeting, kind of correlated directly with what they said. So after the meeting, I walk out and I got a t-shirt, nope, underwear, shorts, and flip-flops. That's all I owned. And I'm walking up, and I love his version of it. He sees me walking, and he goes, oh, Lord, what did I do to deserve this? Please, I know what he's going to ask me. Please, no, no, no. You know, and I walk up, and I ask him, and I break down crying, you know, and here's the cool thing. He didn't say, go home and read the book for a month, and then we'll see what happens. He says, where do you live? I'll come get you today. And see, that's what I needed. Because he looked at me and says, you don't have time. He could look at me and tell. And that's what I needed. I needed somebody to take time out of their day and help me because I'm dying and I don't know what to do. And within a couple of days, we started the book. And within 2 months, I go home and make an amends to my father. That's mind-blowing. I didn't go home and say, I'm sorry. I went home and I talked about the things that I had done to disappoint him. I talked about that I need to start being the son that he deserved. And I started doing those things. You know, we went step by step. He read page for page. He made it exciting. You know, by myself, that book is put you to sleep. But get with somebody who's got an understanding of this book, and this thing comes alive. And we went through the steps, and we talked about what you're supposed to do, that a four-step's not a freaking autobiography. You know, it's about looking for patterns of behavior. It's about looking for why we keep doing the same things over and over. It's so much more in depth. And I got to see on paper how selfish and self-centered I was. It's like, holy cow. You'd think anybody in their normal right mind would be able to see this, but we can't see this stuff. And then it becomes, and it each year becomes more evident because, you know, some things are hard to change. But at 6 months, I start sponsoring a guy. And I end up sponsoring this other guy, and these guys get together, him and some other guys out of a halfway house, and they start this meeting. And some good friends of mine and I in this group, we joined that group. And that group grew and grew and became big. And in our book, it talks about a fellowship will grow amongst you, you know. And that's what happened. My closest friends today that know everything about me are sitting in this room, you know. And some of these guys have watched me since day one. Some of these guys know me since before day one. Some of these guys I sponsor. And I've watched incredible things in their life happen. It's the most amazing thing to get on the other side of a spiritual experience. And this is the part that's the most amazing. Because it's a switch got turned off inside me. Because I don't think about drugs and alcohol. I don't get up and ask, God, please take my obsession away. You know, God's going to do that. I don't have to ask him. But I got a part to play in that. You know, I got to be willing to get off my butt and get involved in other people's lives and try to be of maximum service. We get involved in ACTS. We get involved in halfway houses. Guys that I sponsor started a meeting over at another treatment center. We sponsor guys. We put on spiritual retreats. We do all this cool stuff. Now, here's the cool part. I found a wife out of this. And she's a Southerner. That's like a freaking real rare thing around here. So, she's from North Carolina. It's kind of Southern, you know. She's not a Yankee. So, but anyway, that's kind of a joke amongst my friends and I. Because where we live, everybody's from the North. All of them. So, bought a house. You know, I can remember walking down the street homeless thinking, this was it. Life was never going to get any better. You know, I got family that's got all this money and all this stuff. And I know that money doesn't make you happy, but it doesn't hurt you either. But, you know, and I just thought, that's never going to be for me. I'm never going to have that. I'm a homeowner today. You know, 6 years of sobriety, I own a home. And unless you understand where I'm coming from, I'm proud of that because I never thought I'd be there. You know, I got a nice car in the driveway. I'm working pest control because I don't blow my money today. I got a half a brain today, and I didn't have that before. And that came. That's part of those promises. That came without any fruition on my own. That's one of those that some come, you know, rapidly, some don't. That's one of those that just came. Others, stubbornly, don't always go away. I still got to work on. But I've got everything I could ever want. I got a family that loves me again. I've got friends. I got more friends than I want. And I know that sounds weird, but do you know what I mean? Because I'll trip down. So, you know, life really is cool. But here's the kicker. I sleep like a baby at night. And for years I never slept because of all the things that I did, you know. And I sleep like a baby at night. And that's, if all I ever got out of AA was sleeping good at night, you couldn't chase me out of here. But I got all the things in the world and so much more. My life is, I don't know, I don't have problems today, you know. Anytime I do, my sponsor's going to tell me, why don't you go tell your problems down at the halfway house and see how far that takes you, you know. Because I don't, you know, life has been blessed. As long as I'm willing to do, you know, AA is very simple. It's not complicated. It's not all this, oh, I don't know, you know. Do the steps, get the spiritual experience, and get off your butt and help others. It's really that simple. There is no more. And then watch this whole world build up around you. That's all you got to do. And I'm living proof of that. So I'm going to end it with that, guys. Thanks.